Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast for June 6, 2019. I am not Daniel Bader. I am Andrew Martinick, though. I'm usually on these episodes, I'm usually just not leading them. And we actually don't have Daniel at all. He's enjoying a wonderful looking vacation in Switzerland at the moment with his wife and kid. So I hope he's having an amazing time and not listening to this episode. He should go enjoy himself. But here to enjoy himself with us, with you, Alex Dobie.
How's it going?
It's going pretty well over here. We're just going to have a little one-on-one chat. Just me and you.
We're gonna,
nobody else.
We're going to talk some Android. We're going to talk some 5G. We're going to talk some upcoming phones. Just like the old times.
And, you know, what we're going to talk about, like we talk about every week, we're going to talk about an alarm clock, a bedside alarm clock. That's what we usually
That's my
cover.
Favorite part of the show.
Right. Yeah. The weekly alarm clock update. Well, actually, it's worth a quick mention. This came out back in January, and we are now in June, and it's finally on sale, the Lenovo Smart Clock. And I'm happy to hear that when people finally got their hands on it and actually used it for a while as an alarm clock, it's not really something you could demo very well. You know, you just got to use it in your life, that it's actually good. And Daniel Bader has one right before he left for vacation. Phil, Modern Dad, has one. And Michael, Mr. Mobile, has one as well. And they all just, they generally think it's a good deal for $80 as a, like a Google Home device.
Exactly. I'm a little jealous of all of them because I saw it in Vegas at CES for the first time. And I was actually, moderately excited about it. It was something unexpected. Having come from using the Lenovo Smart Display, having something that is smaller, has a lot of the same functionality, but is smaller, more portable, more of an impulse buy, I think it would be something with a big appeal. And certainly that's what everyone reviewing it seems to be saying.
Yeah, and for me, I don't know if you have much smart home stuff, but I don't really have any smart home things.
I don't have a ton, no.
Yeah, outside of, you know, a couple things and Google Home speakers, all that. This feels like a good buy at $80 compared to the former Home Hub, now Nest Hub, that has this focus on the bigger screen and, you know, being able to control your smart home and things. If you don't care about that, and you don't want or need the bigger display, if for $80, it kind of makes sense to get this thing. And sure, like the screen isn't great and it's kind of small. I think it's 4 inches diagonally. But for the same price as a Google Home, you could easily see this being a better purchase for, I would say, the bedroom or the bathroom, as just something to give you little bits of ambient information. Like, you're not going to sit there and poke around on it, but also, you can easily see this thing going on sale for like $50 in a month because Lenovo.
I would be amazed if it wasn't down to $50 by the holiday sales.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing that Mr. Mobile pointed out in his great video review was he would love to receive this as a gift, maybe not go out of his way to go buy it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a highly giftable item. I'll agree there. In a way that I think perhaps the smart displays were just a little bit out of that sort of price range for a lot of people.
Right. At like $180 or $190.
Yeah,
bucks,
or even more for the big one, I think, over here.
Yeah, that didn't make a whole lot of sense. But for $80, like, this would be a nice standalone thing to give somebody instead of a Google Home Mini as a first home device, because it's just there's something about having the screen there that feels more like easier to get into and easier to start your, you know, interaction with Google Assistant rather than this just like hockey puck thing covered in fabric.
I think the presence of the screen makes it more approachable. Also, the small form factor, the small footprint compared to these larger smart displays also makes it more of an approachable thing. It's not this giant monolith that's going to dominate whatever surface you put it on. It is designed to be small. It's designed to have a screen that gets very, very dark at night so it doesn't disturb you. It's much less of sort of an intrusive piece of technology, if you want to call it that, than anything comparable, I think.
You know what is going to be a massively intrusive piece of technology?
Oh, where's the segue going?
The Galaxy Note 10.
Whoa.
Because it is going to be massive, and it may have or not have various things that are already making people mad, even though it's not coming out probably until October. So, all right, Alex, give us the rundown. Just look at this render that is supposedly the full roughly final design and just tell me that it doesn't look like a Sony phone.
It does. I'll agree with you there. It does look a little bit like a Sony phone. And a little bit of a caveat, because we always, generally the way it works, before we start to see proper leaked renders from the manufacturer, we'll see these sort of CAD renders, they're called, based on the specs and other leaked information that case manufacturers and other people get. OnLeaks is one of the guys who likes to put these together. He's done a good job sort of approximating what the Note 10 should look like, but still, it's not going to be a 100% accurate, pixel-perfect, flawless representation of the Note 10 we eventually get.
Yeah, they fill in some gray areas based on dimensions where you kind of have to guess.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of guesswork involved, but this does look like a big slab of a phone. And, you know, we're already in this year where we have the Galaxy S 10 5G, which is another big slab of a phone. This looks a lot more angular, and that's where sort of the comparison with Sony phones comes in. Because Sony, of course, is going more towards curved screens now. It's moving a little bit away from just having a big cuboid like they've had for the past 5 years.
Yeah.
They're adopting a bit of the Samsung design language, so at the same time you have sort of this convergence there. I mean, look, the Note has always been more boxy, more square, more this big sort of slab of technology, and not your everyday sort of everyman phone. I'm curious to see what direction they go with it. I think the headphone jack thing, supposedly this thing is shipping without a headphone jack, probably inevitable at this point. That's just the way the trends are going. And especially if you're looking at... Yeah, I think probably the final sort of straw for them was Samsung can't get rid of the S Pen. The S Pen takes up a ton of space inside the Note, and you have every other phone that is competing with the Note doesn't have to... this thing taking up space inside that could otherwise go towards battery or space for 5G antennas or stuff like that. So I think that's probably finally what's put paid to headphone jacks and Samsung phones. The other thing, which I think is maybe a little bit more egregious, is we have a very unusual approach to a hole-punch display in the form of this big Cyclops eye right in the center of it.
Yeah, and what's weird about it as well is that like they just came out with this side hole punch or corner hole punch for the Galaxy S10 series. And then they're going to switch to this. I don't quite understand that, even as much as I agree that, you know, the center is from a user experience standpoint, the center is better. It's, you know, for selfies and things, it makes more sense to have it central. From the interface perspective, it makes more sense to have it in this kind of dead zone in the dead middle. But the other weird thing to me is that there's only one camera here. So they're just apparently going to ditch the double camera that you see on the Galaxy S10 Plus. That also seems kind of weird to me.
Yeah, it does a little bit. And I mean, we'll have to see what the justifications are. Firstly, if you're putting the camera where it is, I'm sure it has to do with the layout of the components or whatever, or just freeing up as much space as you can for a screen. Because if you look at the S10 5G, you have not only two, but three cameras up there. And it looks kind of super weird when you pick it up for the first time. I think, you know, it's a little bit futile to sort of second guess everything they're going to be doing. I imagine they probably don't need the time of flight sensor for portrait selfies. Let's be honest, there wasn't a whole lot that Samsung was doing with that second camera anyway on the S10.
That's very true.
Yeah. So maybe it's just a case of what can we get rid of before, you know, eventually we get to these under display sensors. We saw a little bit of that from some Chinese manufacturers this year, in this past week. So,
right.
Yeah. Who knows why it is the way it is. It is a bit of a perplexing decision to put it in the middle, I think, because around the time that Honor was first coming out with the Honor View 20 late last year, they did a lot of market research, and they're using an LCD, so the technology is a bit different. But they did a lot of market research about where was the least intrusive place to put this hole punch. And they decided it was in the place where if you're holding it in landscape mode in gaming, that your thumb generally is going to cover anyway. Samsung went on the other side. One of the other options they were looking at was a central hole punch, and they decided that was actually the worst of all options for them, according to their market research. So I'm not sure whether Samsung just has a much, much smaller hole punch, so maybe it's less noticeable, or they're going with some, you know, there's some other reason that we can't foresee that that we'll have to wait and see, maybe in the next couple of months.
So the rest of the phone, it looks like it's the typical, you know, bezels get smaller, especially that bottom bezel. You mentioned it being kind of boxy. It looks flatter on the top and bottom. Again, just trying to fit as much screen as possible. I think we're talking about a 6.75-inch screen at the highest end. And there's also this disconnect that we're not entirely sure where the lines are being drawn between the potential of a Note 10 and a Note 10 Pro version. And within those, probably at least one separate 5G version. So there's going to be like maybe a 6.3 inch screen and then upwards of a 6.8 inch screen, which would probably be the Pro version. What do you, I mean, do you have any idea what we could expect for a Pro version when the Note is already kind of the Pro version of the whatever the Galaxy S was earlier in the year?
So my theory is it might have to do with, well, a couple of things. Firstly, cost, right? I mean, the Note is already expensive, but when you're adding a whole bunch of extra features, like whether it's more cameras, you know, you can always get more mileage out of a smartphone camera when you give more focal length options, or whether it's just a case of you're using certain components in the Pro that you know you're not going to be able to source as many of for the mainstream version. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the yields aren't higher enough or whatever. I can't tell you what space age feature that might be enabling. You know, maybe it's better in-screen fingerprint. Maybe it is just more cameras. Maybe it is a bigger battery. Maybe they just want to go, you know, maybe they, you know, again, maybe they do their own market research. They figure out that a lot of Note buyers don't necessarily want that extra, extra big phone. And maybe they figured that in a year that we have five Galaxy S10 phones anyway, that maybe a bit of variety in terms of the Note line isn't such a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of just lets them make the S Pen be the one differentiator of the Note line, especially when they already, like you said, they already segmented out the S10 Plus so much. And this has kind of been the problem that they've faced, I would say, since the Note 5, where the Note line and the S line are so darn close together, especially when they started making the plus-sized Galaxy S's so, mm-hmm. So similar in size and capabilities that, you know, what can you do? You can't just keep going larger. Maybe you add, you know, I don't know, maybe they add some kind of interesting camera feature or something, but it really seems like they're kind of standardizing on the core platform. And man, it's really going to throw people off if, you know, all you get, as they like to say, is the S Pen, and then you're going to be losing a headphone jack for it. You know, I feel like they're going to have something there.
Yeah, one of the rumors going around from Ice Universe, who's a Chinese leaker, is that we're going to have not only a 4,500 milliamp hour battery, which is the rumored spec there, but also 45 watt charging, which is faster than the current maximum you get with a Huawei phone with supercharging. I believe it's like tied more or less with what the Mate X is supposed to be promising. So, you know, super, super fast charging, which you need with a big battery. I think in terms of like the placement of the Note, I would look at the track record of the past year. The way things have been going for the past year is with the Galaxy S line getting more safe. It's still a great line of phones, but it has been very, very safe for the past 12 months.
Yeah.
And the Note may be sort of branching out a little bit and doing things a little bit crazier than you might have thought. So it's not just the S Pen, but okay, last year it was a wireless S Pen. It was, you know, moved to a bigger battery for the first time in that kind of Samsung phone. So I think we'll see things sort of develop along that line. It will be interesting, though, to see how, you know, having the freedom of that extra, extra large, extra expensive, crazy Note version that supposedly is in development, how that frees them up to maybe put something unexpected in there and have maybe a little bit of excitement around a Note in a way that we haven't seen for the past few years.
Yeah, it's kind of a somewhat similar to a OnePlus 7, OnePlus 7 Pro situation, mm-hmm. where they can really take the reins off and make the 7 Pro great, or make the Note 10 Pro great, because yeah, the other one's just going to be safe and it'll be there, and it kind of just elevates the whole brand and brand name of the Note in particular. But you wonder if, like you mentioned, with having several different Galaxy S10 series phones, if it dilutes things at all when you're going to be covering everything from a Galaxy S10e, which is about $750, up to a Note 10 Pro that's probably going to start at $1,300,
maybe, or something like that. Maybe for a 5G version, quite possibly, yeah.
You know, it's going to be getting up there pretty quickly. And so it's very interesting. You start to get a little bit of a decision anxiety where you're like, you know, what, like, you know, which one do I want? At least they have the S Pen to differentiate, but I still, man, I just do not see people using the S Pen. They've been making these notes and they've been selling tens of millions of them, and I just don't see people using S Pen. So they must, again, market research must show them that they do.
Yeah, and look, if you want a big Samsung phone without an S Pen, then Samsung already makes that phone and has been making that phone for the past couple of years. I guess the point of the Note has always been, to a certain extent, about the S Pen, because it is the Note, it's in the name. But you also have the Note as this really useful sort of mid-year jumping-off point for technology. And the opportunity to sell something at that, you know, crazy 1,000-plus price point in the way the Galaxy S line really isn't quite there. It is more affordable, though still very expensive. In a different universe, could we have a lot of the cool benefits of that without an S Pen? Sure, but the Note is what got Samsung there. It is the recognizable name. It's, you know, recovered from the flames of the Note 7, of all things. The brand is strong, and it's strong because of, among other things, the pen.
Right, and so as far as we'll talk quite a bit more about 5G later on in the episode here, but I want to quickly mention that there's not going to be any difference in the 5G technology happening in a potential Note 10 Pro 5G than what we have right now, because we're still looking at the same Qualcomm X50 modem. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be...
X55 is early next year, is that right?
Right. So the X50 is still a separate modem off die from the rest, of the SoC. And so it's just going to be looking at the same situation. So we could, very much like we have the S10 5G, which is just an even larger S10 Plus, these 5G versions...
It could just be you got to have that extra battery for the X50 because it's a little bit power hungry compared to what's coming next year.
Exactly. And so that's kind of an interesting thing. Well, actually, do you want to let's swap back and forth here. We were going to get to Android Q Beta 4, but let's put that last. And while we're talking 5G, let's just go straight into it. While you're talking about big phones that need extra battery and extra space to run 5G, you've actually been using the OnePlus 7 Pro 5G.
I have. And it's funny to go from the Samsung side of things, where you have the 5G version, which is bigger and has a bigger battery, to the OnePlus phone, which almost seems to have been designed in reverse from that. They were very clear with Pete Lau, the decision coming from the top, that they wanted the Pro and the Pro 5G to have the exact same dimensions, footprint, weight. Obviously, if you're OnePlus, you have a big accessory ecosystem, so there are financial reasons for that as well.
Definitely.
But it's very interesting to see them making that choice, where actually a lot of companies releasing these early 5G phones, it's a bit of a break compared to the 4G version. So the experience of using this in the hand is identical to a OnePlus 7 Pro 5G. If, picking up both side by side, you've got to check the logo on the back, see which one is a 5G logo to actually see the difference.
And in some ways, that's really, really good, because that's how it should be when, the Galaxy S10 5G is an absolute chonk. It is absolute huge. But at the same time, it means that my LTE version here is gigantic. I mean, we talked about this a lot when the 7 Pro came out. The thing is heavier than it needs to be compared to, the type of the battery performance and display size and all this kind of stuff. It compares, it doesn't compare favorably to the Galaxy S10 Plus. And this, now that we know that this is how the Pro 5G is, that kind of tells us what we need to know about where those design decisions came from.
Yeah, exactly. The other example to look at is Huawei with the, and obviously the internals are different there. They're using their own SoC and their own modem. But to fit 5G into that phone, they had to cut away the battery from the regular Mate 20X compared to the 5G version, which is crazy because you have this huge new power hungry component that's in there to power those 5G radios.
And so you're using it on EE in the UK, which is the first carrier to launch 5G there.
Sure is.
How have you found? So we'll talk about the speeds and things like that. But while you're talking about battery life, how has it fared? And I know you've been doing tons of testing and things, so it hasn't necessarily been normal usage. But do you find that it super drains the battery?
Not particularly. I mean, my experience with the regular 4G OnePlus 7 Pro in terms of battery life has been very, very mediocre anyway. Mediocre is a bit too harsh, but it hasn't been outstanding.
For the size.
For the size, yeah. And the 5G version also is about the same, which, you know, maybe is damning either one with faint praise, I'm not sure. But yeah, they both have perfectly okay battery life. I was expecting a bigger battery drain on the 5G version, which I'm glad isn't there. They do have a new... So there's an initial out-of-the-box firmware update that added something called a smart 5G mode, which I've sent a few emails off to OnePlus to try and get down to the nitty-gritty technical details of what that actually means. It's supposed to be an intelligent 4G, 5G switching feature, but we're not entirely clear on how that is different from just your normal 4G, 5G switching. But obviously they're looking at developing things so that you don't fire up that extra chip to do 5G when you don't need it. And maybe some of those things that they've been working closely with the network have made a lot of difference in terms of, you know, the battery life being pretty much comparable to the 4G version. And that's, pretty good.
That's great. And it's also surprising as, you know, we were around for this transition from very well, well-managed HSPA plus networks to, in my case, WiMAX, and then later on LTE networks that were just absolute trash.
If anyone's old enough to remember Phil Nickinson's HTC Thunderbolt.
Oh my goodness.
Like hour and a half of battery life.
And I used an HTC Evo. And so it's not surprising that we are a little gun shy about battery life. And of course, right now, I mean, the fact that it's not appreciably different in the case of the OnePlus 7 Pro and Pro 5G, that's really good right now because the network is not, you know, it's not yet there. And you talked about this smart 5G mode that's switching back and forth. And while we talk about Qualcomm here, I'll drop a quick disclaimer that my girlfriend works for Qualcomm, but I don't have any inside information that doesn't influence anything that I have to say about Qualcomm. But the Qualcomm, the X50 modem being off die means you do have to manage that switching back and forth. So the fact that they have a smart 5G switching mode kind of indicates that it's, you know, they're aware that there could be a problem of having it just constantly searching for that 5G connection at the same time as, you know, holding on to an LTE connection. And we've seen something similar with our tests of 5G phones on Verizon's network, where it only uses 5G for the downlink. It uses LTE for the uplink. And so you're kind of constantly managing this back and forth at the firmware level, at the hardware level of what your phone is actually connected to. And just that dance alone can use a lot of extra battery life. So the fact that you're not really facing that, it seems, is a good sign for, you know, a year, 2 years down the road, where you're always going to have more and more 5G available and be doing that hop back and forth less and less.
Yeah, I think so. And there's no guarantee that everyone that does 5G this year will do it as well as OnePlus has, and that the network will be as consistent as it has been. But yeah, good signs for what's ahead. And certainly as we look ahead to more chips having the on-die 5G that makes all this stuff a lot more efficient next year, I think we're going to start to see this sort of stuff really kick off from around the time we start seeing that Galaxy S11 sort of territory. That's where we'll see a lot of other countries picking up 5G, countries like maybe Canada, other European countries over here, launching networks. The phones are ready with on-die 5G stuff, and it's going to be probably a pretty great experience for everyone starting next year.
Yeah.
In the meantime, early adopters, you know, there are a few trade-offs, but certainly looks so far like those trade-offs aren't anywhere near as bad as they were in the early days of LTE.
Yeah, it really doesn't seem like it, even though we're still, you know, kind of pumping the brakes on recommending people jump into 5G just to have it. But I mean, in the UK, so you've been using it. You're doing lots of testing, but also just, you know, using the phone. What's your real world feel for it? What's the actual benefit you're seeing in turn? Like, obviously, the speed tests are insane, but, you know, do you actually notice?
The short answer is it depends. The shorter answer is no. it reminds me a lot of the early days of LTE over here. So with LTE, we got it sort of towards mid-end of 2012. And at that point, we already had these very mature HSPA networks So you would see a little bit of a difference, but it wasn't until like the next year and the next year that you start to build on that capacity. You start to see it in more places. So yeah, the speed tests are pretty impressive. You go to the right places, you'll get between 200 and 600 down. This is on E's sub-6 network, which is different. It's a lower frequency to what Verizon's using, which means it's easier to spread it over a wider distance. But it means when you're standing right in front of the cell, you're not going to get those multi-gigabit speeds that you see people posting in photos and stuff. In terms of just day-to-day use, it's been a little bit of a mixed experience. I mean, it is an early network, and just in terms of the way they're handling the switching between 4G and 5G, and the, you know, because the EE has a very solid 4G network and they have a very new 5G network. And so something they're doing is they will show you a 5G icon if you are in the coverage area of 5G. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're always using just 5G. And this is something where they were very upfront about in our briefing. We've been in touch with them to sort of clarify some details some more. But it is possible that if you see a 5G icon on a phone that's connected to EE's 5G, it might not always be using the 5G network. If it figures out that it can get better speeds by combining a bunch of LTE from different towers, it will do that. And it will still say it's on 5G because you're in the 5G coverage area, but it's just managed to get you a better signal from all the 4G towers. And it's a bit debatable as to whether that's disingenuous or not. I can kind of see both sides. But yeah, again, it's early days. I think this will be much less of a pain point going forward. And in the meantime, the only thing I've noticed as I've sort of been going around is you will sometimes see a 5G icon. You run a speed test and you'll get sort of suspiciously LTE looking speeds.
Yeah.
Because you'll, especially in sort of congested parts of central London, you'll find that, you know, maybe the 5G signal will be weak, but the 4G will be better, but it will also be quite congested. So you'll run this 5G speed test that runs an awful lot like a 4G speed test. So those are sort of the outliers, and that can be quite confusing if you're sat in a Starbucks and you're not getting the speeds that you expect on 5G. But it's pretty obvious when the real, you know, the real proper strong 5G kicks in, because then you get those consistent, like, multi-hundred megabit per second speeds. And that's the range of that stuff is only going to increase in the next year or so.
Yeah, my first response when we were talking about this is that that just seems rather deceptive. But you understand why EE is doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can understand that, like, it's just the network's providing you the best possible speed no matter what. I just wish that, you know, in some cases, especially right now, LTE is going to be faster.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many variables involved in where you are and in buildings and all that kind of stuff that I just want the status bar to reflect what I'm actually hanging on to at that moment, not what I could.
What you could theoretically get. Yeah. And again, we go back to the early days of LTE over here, because back then, often you would get a weak LTE signal and then it would drop to HSPA, which would be faster. But when it did that, you would see it, the, you know, the 4G change to an H, which was a little bit more upfront about what it was doing. And you could certainly make an argument, although E would disagree, I guess, that in showing you a 5G icon when you're not actually using 5G, even if you are in the coverage area, that could be seen as a little bit deceptive.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, it ultimately it can lead to people thinking that they're having a negative experience or a less premium experience with 5G anyway.
Why is it giving me 15 megabits a second down? Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of the AT&T 5GE problem. It's like, oh, you put that status bar icon up there, and now that it, you know, word's kind of out about it, everybody is focusing on it and pointing out all of the situations in which they run a speed test that's 2 megabits per second because you're in New York, and it says 5GE in the status bar. So this isn't something that's going to happen all that often, especially when normal people, you know, when we finally recommend that normal people buy 5G phones. But it's kind of one of these things that you have to remember that the carrier is for the most part in control of the status bar icons, and it can decide what you're seeing up there, even if you're not necessarily connected to it. Now, we had this, of course, we're just going to keep going back and telling people how old we are, but back in the HSPA days, when you had that H there, there was no determination that you were on 14 or 42.
Yeah,
HSPA.
Over here, the biggest difference we got was like H versus H plus, but you had all kinds of things like you had HSPA, HSPA plus, DCD, HSDPA, or some whatever the top level one was. Uh-huh. And the speeds could vary a whole lot depending on where you were on that scale.
Right. So that's kind of the issue with status bars in general. And it's just like, I wonder why we even show the little bars next to the icon anymore. It's just, it doesn't really matter. I mean, a weak connection or a strong connection, it doesn't really matter. It's all about the backhaul and how many mm-hmm. people are on that tower at a given time. And that's kind of the issue with a lot of the discussion about 5G networks right now is there's just nobody using them. When you walk around, like you said, you walk around London, you know, how many dozens of people are using a 5G phone on the same tower as you, you know, yeah, versus an LTE tower that, you know, may have, or of course, there are dozens, hundreds more of them, but hundreds and hundreds of people on each one.
It's going to be in the single digits for sure. Yeah, there's going to be, even though it is a public network now, and London is one of the biggest, you know, it is the biggest launch city. It's, yeah, you're not going to be dealing with anywhere near the kind of congestion that you will be a year down the line. At the same time, they're going to be lighting up, you know, 100 or so, you know, hundreds of sites a month. They're going to be opening up more spectrum. The backhaul for every one of these sites is a 10 gigabit link, at the very least. So as they're building all this stuff out, I think we're going to see probably the increase in capacity and the increase in coverage and the increase in speed probably outstrip the demands of fresh people coming on board, especially until we get to sort of that magic period of, you know, next spring where the really appealing 5G phones start to appear.
And so for EE, outside of the OnePlus 7 Pro 5G, what other phones are they going to have?
So they have the Galaxy S10 5G right now. I believe the Oppo Reno is on the cards as well. And possibly one more, which I will have to check the website for. But those are the three main ones.
And then we'll see what happens with
the HTC 5G bringing hub, which is not a phone.
Oh, the hotspot thing.
But still runs Android, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, that thing. That's the one that's on Sprint as well.
Right, right.
But you're not getting the V50 ThinQ 5G,
we are, I think. Let me double, maybe that was the one I forgot, which, you know, can't really blame me.
Understandable.
For
because last bit of 5G here is that Sprint's 5G network is actually available in four cities. I will give one thing to Sprint here, and they put their 5G coverage, or what, you know, as good as they can approximate it, they put their 5G coverage right on the same coverage map as their 4G and 3G and 2G coverage, which mm-hmm. Verizon, I don't know about EE, but Verizon definitely doesn't do that. It has like a help support page where it tells you specific parts of like specific neighborhoods in Chicago that they have 5G in. What does EE do it?
They do the same way Sprint does, but I mean, if you're using millimeter wave, the reason why you don't want to do that is because it would be like a single pixel on a map
exactly.
for every single cell. EE is doing it, that they're overlaying it over the top of the 4G and 3G map, and you can see as different areas light up. And you know, you can even see, like, I believe it must be updated pretty regularly because you can sort of see towers being lit up from stretching out from some of the launch cities. So, for example, Cardiff was one of the launch cities, and they have a little bit of coverage stretching down to Bristol, which is one of the later launch cities later in the year. So it seems to be updated pretty regularly, and you can get a pretty good idea of where the coverage is supposed to be. Doesn't necessarily mean that'll be reflected in the real world. I was up in sort of north-ish London in St. Pancras area today, and the coverage map would lead you to believe that 5G coverage there is pretty good. Took me a decent walk south before I actually picked up a 5G signal. And even then, I believe it was the sort of crossover area where it was getting me on a bunch of LTE cells to get a faster speed while still showing me the 5G icon. So you have things like that. The coverage maps aren't maybe 100% reliable, but they do give you a decent approximation. You can see them spreading out to eventually, hopefully, cover the same area as that 4G.
So for Sprint's part, they're talking, and your point on the differences between sub-6 and millimeter wave are well taken here. So Sprint is also using sub-6, and so they're able to kind of piggyback on their current towers and spread out over a wider area. So large sections of Atlanta, Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, and Kansas City. So you know, they're talking about numbers like between 150 square miles in Atlanta to approximately 575 square miles in Dallas-Fort Worth area. You know, these are wide, flat areas with dense populations that they can, you know, test really well. And there are also areas where Sprint is also are already very strong and has a good network footprint for LTE. So these are kind of the best case scenarios mm-hmm. for Sprint. Whereas you see, you know, Verizon talking about Chicago and using all these tiny cells and millimeter wave in the densest part of the city right in the loop. And, you know, that's kind of a different technological achievement. My question is, you know, what's your step two, three, four, you know, all, you know, step 100 of getting these things out to wider areas? I, you know, we have to see. And Sprint is obviously facing this whole situation with a merger with T-Mobile that could throw all kinds of wrenches in there. So don't, yeah, exactly. Don't go out and buy an LG V50. It's just not really worth it in general. Okay, we're gonna talk Android Q here in a minute, but we need to take a quick break, and we're gonna talk about our thrifter that is a sponsor. Our sponsor today is Thrifter. You'll find them at thrifter.com and on Twitter, which is kind of the best way to do it, at Thrifter Daily, because when these deals come up, you want to get on them right away. So, what is Thrifter all about? It's all about saving you money on the types of things you're already going to be buying. You may be buying them, you know, one time, you're doing all your research, or you buy them regularly, stuff around the house, you know, small electronics and accessories, things like that. And it's not just electronics and phones related kind of things. I'm scrolling through Thrifter right now. We have deals on tablets and speakers and things like that, of course, but also like a garden hose and a vacuum cleaner and a Lowe's gift card and gift cards for Baskin-Robbins ice cream, all kinds of different stuff. It's just a good deal. And the way that Thrifter works is we have all these people that are looking at the deals. They know historically what's a good deal, what's not. I know we've all been burned looking at special sales going on, especially on online retailers where they say, oh, look, it's 70% off. Well, yeah, it's 70% off all the time. Thrifter's only going to tell you when it's 80% off, you know, when it's 90% off, when they know that it's an amazing deal. And they'll tell you, this is the best deal we've ever seen. So what we like to do for these Thrifter sponsor segments is point out something that we're eyeballing on thrifter.com right now. Alex, what are you seeing that's a great deal?
So this is a nice cheap little impulse buy if you're looking at getting into the whole smart home thing like we were talking about before. A two-pack of Zuzi smart plugs, really small, really easy to use, connects to Amazon Alexa or Google Assistant, and also has its own standalone app. Two-pack for $15.99 with a code on thrifter.com.
That's good. Smart plugs are kind of the easy, outside, I would say smart plugs and smart light bulbs mm-hmm. are the easiest things to get into. Plugs even more so because you don't have to deal with the whole light switch problem that the, you know,
exactly, yeah.
that they have to deal with. Super useful for all sorts of things, especially if you travel a lot. It's nice to have that peace of mind that you can turn things on and off remotely and, mm-hmm. and make sure they're all off. And it's even better when they're cheap. My choice is something cheap as well. A pair, count them two, of Anker's Soundcore Mini 2 Bluetooth speakers for $38, normally $62. So there's a little bit of a discount on them, and then there's a coupon code that you can add through Amazon. I love all of these Anker speakers just because, you know, like Bluetooth speakers, there are really fancy ones, but the best ones that I've found are the ones I don't care about because they're mm-hmm. so cheap. They're like $40 for two, or I like the kind of rectangular. Geez, they all have crazy names. Anyway, it's a Soundcore 3 or something like that. You know, that's like it's $40 or $60. And so you can just bring it to a party or you take it camping or whatever. And you know, it's not like you're just going to throw it in the trash at the end of the day, but you don't care about it in the same way you do if you have like a $600 JBL speaker that, you know, frankly sounds a lot better, but you know, you're not going to take it everywhere with you or let everybody do whatever they want with it. So mm-hmm. I like these little the two speakers also because they pair together and they give you a Bluetooth stereo connection even through one device, which is really nice.
Sweet. Yeah,
so that's all mine. If you'd like to get in on either of those two deals or the other four tabs that I just closed because I had lots of other decisions to make as well, you should go to thrifter.com or, like I said, follow them at Thrifter Daily on Twitter. If you're on Twitter at all, these things just pop up, especially short-term deals like on gift cards and things like that that are, you know, quick ways to grab a couple gift cards, save 5, 10%. That's really what Thrifter is great for. We thank them for showing up and helping us out on the AC podcast. Okay, Alex, Android Q Beta
Android
4,
Q.
Has your phone rebooted yet?
My phone rebooted immediately after I pushed the update to it last night, so I've been one of the lucky people.
Nice.
Yeah. so I updated my Pixel 3a from Android P directly to the new beta, so that might have something to do with it. A lot of the people getting these boot loop issues seem to be going from the earlier beta versions of Q, but I've been absolutely fine with it so far.
And by the time everybody's listening to this, Google has kind of sorted this out. For me, on my Pixel 3 that was already on the Beta 3, it just took the OTA and it just wouldn't reboot. It was stuck for like 40 minutes rebooting. And after I forced it into recovery and rebooted, it downloaded a new version and went again and was totally flawless. Some people said that they got really stuck and recovery wouldn't show up. I think that's just kind of your typical... people aren't used to using recovery, and so they get kind of messed up and they end up factory resetting. Google said that it paused the rollout for a minute. There seem to be different issues for different phones, like you were saying, depending on, you know, if you're up, you know, some people were on, you know, the first beta and then they just tried to update to beta 4 and things got a little weird. I still think it's great that Google offers OTAs on these on the betas or previously developer previews. I think it's really good. People should know what to do before they get involved with this. So after your phone finishes rebooting, there isn't a whole lot. Like, it was maybe not worth your hassle, but beta 4, what did it do, Alex? We changed a little bit of the gesture behavior, a little bit of the design, but not in the ways that Google said that it was going to be changed.
Yeah, so the a little bit of confusion here. So Google released a GIF at the same time of how gesture input is supposed to work in Q, only what we actually have now is a little bit different. And you would assume that the GIF they have, since it looks a bit more polished, is what we'll eventually go towards maybe in the next couple of betas. But for now, what we have is sort of a more polished version of the full gestural input that we had in the Beta 3 release. So it's the same, but it works a bit better. There's less jank switching between apps. The animations are a bit more fluid. It works better with things like picture-in-picture mode now. It's just a nicer experience. There are still some pain points there. Certain third-party apps that use the hamburger menus are still a bit annoying. Slack is super annoying, although some of Google's apps do have sort of an exclusion area on the side that the hamburger menu scrolls in. And so you can still scroll in on the left-hand side, and you've got to scroll in from the right, which I guess is better maybe if you're right-handed, maybe not so much if you're left-handed. And there are going to be these pain points that we sort of have to figure out as we go through the next few versions, I think. But so we have that. That's the sort of the continuing evolution of gesture navigation on Android is one of the big themes. And in addition to that, we have a lot of other smaller things. So we have the highly annoying inability to, well, the sort of forced direction for swiping notifications. So if you swiped in one direction, you would dismiss. If you swiped the other direction, it would be notification options. You would see your notification channels and priorities and stuff. They've got rid of that now. It works the same way as it used to on Android Pie, which is great because I hated that. And in addition, it's just a lot of other really, really small tweaks, which you would expect given that we're just a couple of months away probably from the final version of Q dropping.
And I didn't actually mind the two-way swiping thing. Once I knew, you know, I just got it through my thick skull that I could only swipe one way. But then you realize that you don't need to access the notification channel settings that quickly.
That's not something you need a quick gesture for. Yeah, I think that's what Google realized.
No, you can hide it behind a long press. Like, that's totally fine.
Exactly.
But I do, in general, I like Android Q's simplification of the notification priority. So they have... what is it, noisy and quiet, or noisy mm-hmm. and silent, something like that. And
yeah.
So it's really easy to say, I want this to alert me. I want this to not alert me. And you can do it right from the notification when it comes in without jumping into the separate settings. And, you know, you can still mess with notification channels and have noisy and quiet for each individual channel inside an app if you really want to get granular.
That whole channel setup that it forced you into a couple of versions ago is just so impenetrable now for most people. I mean, it's confusing even for me.
There's so many.
Yeah, it's such a mess.
My favorite example is Google Maps, which I'll pull up the tweet at some point here. I believe it's like 55 different notification channels
yeah,
for Google Maps.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
Which is really just fantastic. I took a scrolling screenshot of it on a Samsung phone, and it looks like a pencil. It's ridiculous how many there are. But so the nice thing is that it doesn't just... So it of course, makes it make noise or be silent, as the name would suggest, but it also actually segments them out in the notification shade. So it's no longer just chronological. It's chronological within noisy, and then you get a break, and then it's chronological within silent down below, and they're collapsed. So it's kind of... My good example is, yeah, I don't want... So like, I want notifications from WhatsApp messages, but I don't want the... like a group message to show up and you know make noise because groups can get really chatty. You can just switch those and you'll always have individual WhatsApp messages at the top and you'll have group messages grouped up below and it won't make noise or vibrate, but also it won't show up at the top of your notification shade. Could be really useful for multiple email accounts or you know something like that where you really want that delineation visually as well as audibly.
Can't wait for everyone's next version of their custom UI to just break that horribly.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been the issue with... I mean, look, Google Maps even was a perfect example.
Anything to do with notifications is just prime territory for that kind of stuff.
Notifications are the holy grail of, you know, leading to engagement and monetization and everything for all of these apps. And so they will go out of their way as many ways as possible to get you to turn notifications on and get you to switch them around. And you can bet that Facebook is going to go out of its way to trick everybody to turn on all the notifications and make them as loud as possible. Now, I don't know how the interface is going to change. It seems pretty finished to me in terms of the notifications because it really is building on the foundations that were there two versions ago, but still.
And we have final APIs now, so that's kind of indication that a lot of stuff is going to be set in stone, not everything completely. Obviously, gestures are still, there's still some work to go there, but we are getting towards the final stretch where some things just will not change from now on.
Right. And so as far as the gestures go, look, they're better than Android 9 Pi by a wide margin. But in terms of it just makes more sense. The little pill swiping, you know, for quick multitasking, the Q gestures are way better. Being able to just swipe quickly back and forth on the bottom works really well. The back button, on the other hand, is atrocious. And so that kind of balances it out a little bit for me. I think I'm still in the positive column overall, but the whole swiping in from the left or the right and having it do the same thing, you mentioned the slide and drawer problem. We have to wait for developers to create exclusion zones in their apps where you can swipe in and get the drawer and swipe everywhere else to get back. But those exclusion zones are not standardized. So they're wherever the developer wants them to be, and there's no visual indication of where they are. You just have to remember, Slack sets its exclusion zone for the swipe in drawer in the bottom third of the screen, but the Play Store sets it in the top third, and you know this one is this big and this one's that big. And that's just really going to get quite messy.
Yeah, it's something that may well be standardized further down the line in some future sort of version of Google's design language. But I guess we are just sort of in this weird stage now where some apps have completely got rid of the hamburger menu completely. So Google Messages, the Dialer app, a lot of the Pixel apps, with the exception of the Play Store, do that. It's still not really clear whether you know Google is going to insist on moving away from that just in general for the entire platform. Obviously, we have tons of apps going back to the Jelly Bean and KitKat days that have built out this sort of UI structure that a lot of us are very familiar with. And having something that directly clashes with that is going to be a pain point for a lot of people. And we'll just have to hope that when it comes time to launch the next round of Pixels, that you know, app developers will be quick to add those exclusion zones, and that people will just learn the way things are. But yeah, there's definitely going to be some teething issues there.
That's really an interesting point about the slide in drawer. It's kind of turned into a crutch. And this is not just an Android problem, or it might not be a problem at all. It's not just an Android observation. This is something popularized by Android, but has made its way across iOS and the web and web apps and progressive web apps, all these different things, Electron apps, they all use it. And it's just kind of, in many cases, turns into a dumping ground for all sorts of things. Obviously, there are good examples, like Slack really benefits from it because you swipe in from the side and you see your full channel list, just like you do on the desktop. You see the channel list on the side. But then there are other things like you're putting all of these options in a hamburger menu, and the hamburger menu is so long that you can scroll the hamburger menu. Maybe some of those things should have been surfaced into the main interface, or into bottom navigation bar, or something like that. And hopefully this transition will help. I mean, look, we're really being hopeful here. Hopefully they're going to use this opportunity with the back button situation to transition to being less reliant on the hamburger button as a core part of the interface, bring back some navigation bars and things like that, especially as phones get taller and taller and you have more vertical space to be able to work with. Now you also have less space at the top where you can actually reach that third of the screen, especially on something like the new Sony phones that are extremely tall. There are those problems, but that's also something to think about with the back button. There is a nice accessibility to being able to swipe in anywhere on the screen. It's wherever your thumb lands, that's where you can swipe in. But is that necessarily better than something like OnePlus's gestures, which feel like a nice, simple version?
Yeah.
A lot of people have talked about OnePlus's gestures being better than Android Q's.
I like them a lot. I would agree with those people. In terms of the hamburger menus, I think it's a case of one side of Google's designers moving a little bit faster than the others, when you're moving fast to replace an imperfect gesture setup in one version of Android, and you have a year to work on it, and then, everyone else is sort of lagging behind, there's going to be issues there, of course. But, I would be perfectly happy if stock Android adopted just the OnePlus method. Nothing on screen, nothing to worry about, no, weirdness with swiping in. Just swipe up from the bottom. You're not interfering with any gestures in any apps. It's just a swipe up, or swipe up and hold, or swipe up from either side. It doesn't matter which hand you hold it in. It's not interfering with the hamburger menus. Everything just works.
And so the interesting thing that I think we may have pointed out at our Google I/O podcast was, so the Android 9 Pie gesture system is dead, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But AOSP and the core of Android is still going to support two navigation systems, the legacy three button back home recents and the new Android Q gesture system. Now, of course, on something like a Pixel, you're just going to have Android Q's gesture system. Other manufacturers are allowed to do whatever they want still, but they have to support Android Q's gestures, and they have the option to support back home recents, just from an accessibility standpoint and an upgrade standpoint, things like that. When, phones come from previous versions that are already using, like a Samsung phone ships out of the box with just a regular three button nav with the buttons on the wrong side, but that's a different argument. They need to be able to update to that too. So we're going to see more standardization of the gestures, but manufacturers can still ship their own gesture navigation, like OnePlus and Motorola and anybody else, alongside Q's, and still have the option to fall back to three buttons if they want to.
Yeah, in the long run, we're making sort of baby steps here towards unified gesture nav on Android. It's still going to be a bit of a nightmare, I think, for the next year or so. You're still going to have a ton of different sort of competing gesture navigation system, which for a lot of people won't be a big deal. A lot of people won't necessarily be going from one Android manufacturer's gesture system to another.
No, that's an us problem,
definitely. But yeah, if on the Pixel we are starting to standardize around something, and if that eventually leads to things sort of coalescing around that, around something that's a bit more consistent and around something that app developers above everyone else can sort of can plan for, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I really liked, there was some confusion over the requirement to use gestures, this, that, and the other thing. But I do like that Google did say that they knew, I think it's new phones. No, it has to be any phone updated to Q has to have the option of the Q gestures. Now they can, I'm sure, hide it however they want and make sure that it doesn't, you know, get in the way of the type of experience that they want, especially on a device that's getting an upgrade from Pi. But that's kind of a big step for Google to require that you support that. So, I mean, especially for, again, an us problem, being able to select that for our own phones and also be able to tell people, like, this is what you can expect to have on your phone. Because with this proliferation of all these different gesture systems in the last couple of years, you never know. I mean, even when somebody shows you a screenshot of, you know, what what phone they're using, it may not be clear how they accomplish the most basic part of using the phone, which is just being able to go back home and multitask. That's what's kind of crazy about the whole ecosystem.
And that's the kind of thing that is probably going to need some sort of tutorial when you first, as part of the setup process, because it's something that you can't really see. And okay, a lot of people are going to be familiar with the iPhone style tab at the bottom, but other things require interacting with something that you can't see. It's not just a button that's there all the time.
Yeah, I have to say that it seems like iPhone users manage that transition starting with iPhone 10 just fine. Things are a little more advanced on Android Q, advanced / confusing, maybe a little bit on the confusing side with the back swipes, just because just the back button in general has always been a little confusing. But, you know, the iPhone has struggled with side-in gestures for going back in apps for a while now. And so that's always been a little bit of a mess too. So I think it's manageable. It's just, like you said, it's that first time use, that first setup where you're like, oh, how does this work? You know, can you get, I mean, the tutorial that's in Android Q right now, when you go to switch to the new gestures, is not very useful. It's like two animated GIFs that show you a couple basic things. Yeah. I'm just trying to look out for people that they're not going to be able to get it from that. And it's not going to be clear how to quick multitask. And it's going to be very much like the double tap recents to switch between two apps, where you could just blow somebody's mind by tapping the recents button twice every
Android
single time.
Android never told you to do that. It never told you that was possible.
Never. It never said anything. And there are going to be, you know, things like that. You know, not even knowing that you can swipe in from both sides of the screen to go back.
I guarantee you there's going to be someone that buys a Pixel 4 and has no idea you can go back in apps.
Right, they're just going to go home every time. That's all they know how to do. You just go home, and you know, that is going to get a little weird for apps that, again, have become a little bit too reliant on the back button, maybe. I mean, Google has to keep a back gesture in there until the end, until the end of time.
Yeah, it's far too built into it's going to take like multiple years to get rid of that if they have to claw every last part of it out, because it's tied into things as basic as just collapsing the keyboard. You still need a back button for that, and it still appears
in closing the menu.
It's going to be with us for a while.
Exactly. And there's still hilariously still this problem that's kind of exaggerated by having a swipe in gesture rather than a button. Is if you hit the top level of an app and you hit back,
it closes the app,
which feels like you should be able to just stop doing that at some point. Like, just stop letting apps close. When you hit the top and you hit back, just don't do anything. Like, make home be your only escape. That's, you know, stuff like that that's endemic.
But it's also confusing because you can use the back, you know, you can have this thing, which I'm sure you probably encountered, where you jump from one app to the next. So maybe, you know, I don't know, Slack will open a tweet or something, and it'll open the Twitter app, and you go back, and it'll, you know, which kind of makes sense. But then where do you draw the line? you know, how many apps can you go back before you just keep hitting, you know, before you reach the top of the stack? How do you define the top of that stack? I'm sure we start to move away from the back button, maybe in future versions, that's something Google's eventually just going to have to address.
Well, I think that's a great place that we can end this episode while we go learn how to use the back gesture in Android Q.
We've reached the top of the stack and we're going to press home.
we're gonna press the back button one final time here and close it out. I will let everybody know that if you were following the Google Stadia announcement, I think they've done three now. Going on today, we're going to have a separate podcast landing in the Android Central feed. We're going to have Russell Hawley and some of the rest of the gaming team going deep into Stadia, because Alex and I, you know, we pay attention, but we don't know anything compared to those guys. They know everything that's going on with Stadia and how it relates to the rest of the gaming world. So Look for that in the Android Central podcast feed here in within the next couple of days. We should be getting out first. Otherwise, you know, who knows? They're going to show up before us. And now I look like we're behind the times.
Yeah.
But Stadia does look really interesting. I'm going to be listening to that episode to hear all of their takes on it, because I can say, oh, it looks pretty cool, but I don't really, you know, I'm ready to hear their plaudits and their complaints.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to lock it down here. A tight 1 hour Android Central podcast. Think about if we would have brought the gaming folks on, this would have been 3 hours probably. But that gives them their room to talk about their thing, and we can talk about gestures for days and days. So, Alex, to get all of your hot takes on Android Q gestures and everything else, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Alex Dobie. You can find me on Instagram at that same name. You can find some of my stuff on androidcentral.com. And you can, most importantly, find hot takes in video form on youtube.com/androidcentral.
Highly recommend. The videography is of a very high standard, and the takes are of a very warm
piping hot
and standard. Okay, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Andrew Martinik, MARTONIK. You can find me not on the Android Central YouTube channel, although I show up now and then when I'm forced to, but mostly with written things on the website. Until next time, folks, have a good one.
See you later.